Welcome back to The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. As you know, The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative new technologies to stop the destructive power of the world's worst wildfires. I've got an amazing guest today. I've got Luke Wolf. What an amazing last name, I have to say. Luke, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, quite the last name, right?
It is. It's the best, right? I mean, you've got an extra O and this and that, you know, some adornments that I'm missing, but the essence is the same. So, yeah, Luke, right. I noticed you were a special agent for the U.S. Forestry Department. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, I was a special agent criminal investigator for the U.S. Forest Service.
So what type of investigations did you do?
Oh, wow. Everything, really. You know, our duties as a special agent in the U.S. Forest Service just really handle all the felony level and complex investigations affecting national forest system lands, you know, basically crimes on you know, your national forests. And so, you know, went from everything, anywhere from, of course, you know, fire investigations, arson, to, you know, timber theft, threats on employees, to archaeological, you know, resource damage and theft, you know, looting caves,
wow,
all kinds of, you know, here, you know, it's primarily out of Arizona and New Mexico. So we had a lot of, you know, smuggling operations down on the Mexico border. And then, of course, marijuana dope grows, you know, all over the forest, worked a lot of that. And then, of course, we, you know, as a federal agent, we, you know, I worked with, and, you know, with the FBI, DEA, ATF, you know, whatever, you know, and local county sheriffs, was a big, you know, part of our interface. And so, yeah, anything kind of affecting our national forest,
really wide range.
We dealt with it. Yeah.
What year did you become a special agent?
So I left the fire side of the shop with the Forest Service in 2003, and that's when I switched to investigations.
That's when what?
That's when I switched over to law enforcement and investigations.
I see. So in 2004 is when you became a special agent?
Yeah, 2003.
So during the course of 2003... you know, how many times, if you can recall approximately, did you, you know, stand in front of the mirror going, special agent? And
not too many times.
Not too many.
Not too many because, yeah, I had to get through the academy first. So yeah, I reserved that. So yeah, but it was nice to get that eventually, because that's a long, hot summer in Southeast Georgia. I'll tell you that.
Oh, no kidding. Right. Right. So are there things that you learned along the way? And I know you're still doing investigations, right? Privately.
Correct.
as an expert witness investigator. What are the types of things that you're investigating now?
Yeah, mainly just all these major fires that we're having. I mean, that's really the, you know, I do a lot of things, you know, of course, but my specialty is wildland fire investigation, and that's primarily my workload, you know, with my little firm. That's, you know, what I concentrate on. I'm a one man firm.
Okay.
So
do you have any good employees?
Yeah. Yeah. Just the one,
you're the best employee there, right?
Yeah. Best one here. So I'm employee of the month every month. So
that's great. So you get the parking place and everything.
Yeah, I get it all. Yeah.
So when you're investigating fires now, are you investigating them with an eye towards possible criminal behavior or civil liability, or what's the big call for you now?
It's both, but primarily it's you know, the civil liability side of it. You know, it's basically, you know, as a origin and cause investigator, you know, that's what I look for, is you know, when and where did it start, and who started it. And then,
okay.
You know, that's
whether
really
it was intentional or not, right?
Whether it's intentional or not. Yeah. As far as, you know, the Code of Federal Regulations go, those are strict liability laws, and doesn't matter if you started it on purpose or not, you're responsible. So that's usually where it is. And so I just provide that information, my findings, and yeah,
And then they do what
that's
they
the
do with it, right?
and they do what they do. We let the attorneys go from there.
Yeah, I think we're going to see more and more uses for what you do in civil liability cases, because these fires are very expensive to the victims of them. And I would imagine
Absolutely.
that, right, while you're really not on the side of or in the sector of figuring out, what are the damages worth, you still have to identify who is responsible for it. And then I
Yeah,
guess they go
absolutely.
after their insurance, right?
Correct. Yeah, it's a big price tag. I mean, you can just look a couple years back with PG&E going bankrupt, probably the one of the largest public bankruptcies on record, probably. I
Ever,
mean,
yeah.
that's 24 plus billion dollar bankruptcy. So yeah, and it was all tied into wildland fire. And so it's definitely a concern for a lot of people.
Were your fi Did you investigate that case?
Yeah, so that was really started my firm in 2016, right when I left the U.S. Forest Service, and in 2017, 2018, 2019, I was pretty much primarily involved in every fire, all the cases, all the big fires in California.
So, are there takeaways from what you found? Are there things that people who unwittingly created fires do consistently that other people who don't want to unwittingly create those fires should learn from?
Well, the majority of those cases, of course, were all power line caused fires. So, there is that. And, when you recognize that problem, then there's, it was pretty consistent over the years with those Santa Ana wind events and, the power lines. And obviously, caused a lot of fires and a lot of damage and, primarily almost, all the fires that I investigated through those years, they were all power line caused. And so, definitely recognize the problem there. And, where it goes from here, we'll see, as
Yeah.
far as preventing those. But, that's the first step in prevention is, you got to know what's causing it.
Right.
And,
So when we say power lines, that's a pretty big bucket right there. Are there specific things? Is it like arcing at the capacitor? Are the lines dipping? Are the lines touching each other? Are they too close to vegetation? Like specifically, what is it about power lines that leads them to generate fires?
Well, you kind of just hit them all right there.
Okay.
It can be vegetation, trees falling into the lines. It can be lines, slapping each other in a high wind or whatever. There can be apparatus failures. Say a conductor or something, fails. Any kind of debris into the line, may get blown. Let's just say fall into or blown into an active power line, which will create a spark so that, hits the ground, and that's all you need. Just one little
Right, and
spark,
if she's
and
off and
it's off
running,
to the
huh?
races.
So maintenance programs would really be important to make sure that you don't have, faulty equipment or vegetation growing up into your power lines. And I know the utilities
Correct.
probably invest a lot in that.
Yeah,
You
utilities
can't.
spend a lot of time and effort in making sure their equipment is sound and that the vegetation is where it's supposed to be, their vegetation management. And, but of course that's not always 100%. Everybody gets behind sometimes, and sometimes they spend a lot of time even inspecting their poles, just to make sure that they're sound. And if they find that they're not, they replace them and do those things. But yeah, that's a big part of their program, I know, as far as the
That's a huge
utilities
job,
go.
right?
Yeah, huge job.
Yeah, and then early detection along the power distribution grid, right? If
Right.
we know that's where we're going to
Yep.
start, you don't have to have cameras pointing everywhere, right? If
Right.
90% of your fires are here, then put 90% of your cameras here
Right.
would make sense. What about vegetation treatment? Does it make sense to, apply retardant underneath the lines in the area where you're likely to have an ignition so that if something does start, it doesn't take off?
Yeah, I think
I'm talking about like chemical treatment, right? With
correct. Yeah, that's a great place to start. That's kind of been a kind of a new product topic that's come up over the last couple of years is using this. Basically, it's long-term, ground applied retardant. It's basically the same stuff that's in the air tankers that are dropped, on an active wildland fire. But you can come and put it in, months in advance, and have that in those, whether it's a roadside or underneath a power line or next to a railroad track, where you might have that threat and that possibility. And then, throw some ground applied retardant on it. That'll last a long time. It'll last through rainstorms or whatever. And it can definitely help mitigate, the possibilities of starts for sure.
And I'm sure it's expensive to do that over when you look at California having like 40,000 miles of transmission lines, but probably
Absolutely.
cheaper than when people die and, neighborhoods are lost.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you compare that cost, it's pretty cheap upfront cost if it's effective. And you've got to, that's a big part of it. But just the PG&E example, I mean, it's they could have spent a let's just say $100 million maybe treating those areas, and those fires were, they were responsible, 20 plus billion dollars damages and numerous deaths.
So, and not every instance of arcing is going to lead to wildfire. Because you have to have both the arcing conditions present in the same vicinity as, easily flammable fuels, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
Dry
you have to have a
vegetation,
reason.
high winds. So are there heat maps, so to speak, no pun intended, of the areas where you're most likely to have that confluence of power line fault and perfect conditions for ignition?
Yeah, so there's I mean, obviously local knowledge, is huge when it comes to this. So, of course the local, we'll just stick with power lines. Local utility are going to know where they're vulnerable in these areas, of course. And then of course the local, firefighters, they understand, when is it fire season, when it, what are the conditions here, and when is it likely for something like this. And so that's why there's, of course, been policy there in California now to where they're anticipating these, strong wind events, Santa Ana winds, whatever, that, they shut the power off. They shut the grid down. And that's that's one way to mitigate this. But yeah, so there is definitely areas as there's just going to be areas that are prone to this. And then of course, the wildland urban interface is just growing, and there's more homes adjacent to these wild areas, that are makes them very vulnerable to wildland fire.
I want to coin a new phrase because we have the wooey, right? And so people think, oh, well, I'm not next to wildland, so I don't have to worry. So we should also have the GUI, which would be the grassland urban interface, because big fires like the Marshall Fire, people weren't thinking, oh, I'm living at the edge of the forest here, I need to watch out, but they were at the edge of large fields of grassland. And I think that most of these fires are started, in the GUI, right? By grasses.
Yeah, the Marshall Fire is a great, perfect example of that, of where, I was standing up there and, January 1st, and in the snow, and, after, what, 1,100 homes just burnt, all from grass. So, yeah, very interesting for sure, because, I mean, wildland fire didn't care what the fuel is. It doesn't have to be wildland, so to speak. It doesn't have to be trees and grass and shrubs. It'll run through homes, just as quickly as
As faster sometimes, right?
obvious. Yeah,
And hotter and dirtier.
absolutely. Hotter and dirtier and yeah, and much more intense and you know, of course that's where, you know, unfortunately we lose lives. Folks staying too long or have, you know, trouble egressing because it gets there a lot quicker than people realize. If you're not familiar with wildland fire and how it works and operates, it'll, you know, as obvious, you know, we can, you know, think about the campfire. Think about what happened in Maui, what's going on in Isley right now. It's just caught off guard. You don't think they have time to get out.
Is it just that we're more aware of it now, or is it really getting worse?
I think it's really getting worse. I'm, you know, this is, you know, I've been, you know, fighting fires and involved in, you know, wildland fires since 1994. And, you know, this is really, kind of a new story over the last couple of years, as far as the intensity and losing entire communities is just, you know, that was unheard of at the first of my career. That didn't happen. Yeah, we lost homes and we lost, you know, some neighborhoods and, but it wasn't nothing at the scale that it is now. I mean, when, you know, Paradise, California basically got wiped off,
Yeah.
completely burned down. You just, that's just not something, you know, beginning of my career.
Is that because the more fires you have, the more likely you're going to have fires that are massively devastating? Or is the nature of the fires changed because the fuels are hotter and drier, or the winds are stronger, or both?
Yeah, I think I'm probably both. Obviously, you know, we kind of talked about how the urban interface is encroaching into the wildland more and more. There's just more and more homes. And then of course I think we're in a you know, regardless of what you think about global warming or what, you know, whatever it is, I think we're just in a climate cycle of, you know, that's where we're at right now. It's
Yeah.
hotter, it's drier, and you know, obviously that's making our wildland fires more intense. You know, there's a lot of topics we could discuss with that as far as forest management in the past and what kind of fuels we have on the ground now and, you know, logging versus not logging and, you know, whatever it is, you know, the absence of, you know, prescribed fire for a long time and then reintroducing that, you know, back into the ecosystem. So there's a lot of things going on, but, you know, it really, in kind of the way I see it, we're just in that climate cycle of, okay, you know, we're hot and dry and these fires, you know, I mean, it's a natural part of, you know, it's nature's, you know, broom or whatever. And
Yeah, right.
it's when the forest is ready and it needs thinned out and burnt, it's going to happen one way or the other. So
Yeah,
whether we do it or Mother Nature takes over and goes ahead and does it. But, you know, now we're having these large stand replacement fires, you know, very often. And they're big and they're nasty and they have progressed since I started, like I said, in the early 90s, mid 90s, you know, through now, you know, fires are just bigger and hotter and more intense.
So it's possible that something that we've done in the last 100 years, whether it's making the climate warmer or forest management practices or logging practices or lack of logging, you know, something has caused change. What can we learn from the way things were to the way things now are now to looking forward? Like, what do you recommend we be doing differently than what we're doing now or that we've done recently?
Yeah, I think, you know, you can connect those dots looking backwards and see what worked and what didn't, and what were the reasons, you know, for the actions, you know, really. And then, you know, you just got to, you know, put the heads together and see, okay, you know, recognize this problem and, you know, what can we do to mitigate it? And what policies looking forward, you know, should, you know, is it one of those aha moments where it's like, you know, maybe we do need to, you know, thin these forests out mechanically ourselves, you know, as humans, or, you know, kind of delve back into the, you know, even like, you know, the indigenous folks, you know, forever, you know, use fire to their
Right.
advantage. And so, how much do we want to do, you know, as far as utilizing, you know, fire as, you know, in a good way,
Yeah.
and not suppressing all fires, you know,
Right.
because that was the policy for a long time. but for a good reason. I mean, that was, you know, a great resource. You know, we're in numerous world wars, you know, back in those times when those policies were started, and you know, we're preserving timber and the watershed. And so, and really it was, you know, we needed to build a bunch of fleet of ships or whatever, we needed timber to be able to do it. And that was a big part of our resource and our economy. And so, you know, it's understandable. But then, you know, maybe it got to a point to where we just left too much fuel out there.
Yeah, you start accruing you, that fuel debt.
Yeah.
Right, you gotta pay for that. So,
absolutely.
You know, and with hundreds of millions of acres out there, I can't imagine that we're going to start some kind of workforce program where we're going to, you know, cut down every third tree in the United States, right? And for the most part, you know, nature has its own cycle of managing wildfire and regrowth in a pretty stable way. So it would seem that our main focus is, you know, where do the trees and the humans meet, and focus our mitigation efforts there, right? Because we can't stop wildfires, you know, nor should we necessarily. What we want to do is we want to, you know, mitigate their impact on the built environment. Is my understanding.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's a big part of it. I mean, the wild land and the urban, you know, they're going to interface, and that's not going to change. Right. You know, more and more folks are moving out to the West, and that's just what's going to happen. And so, yeah, definitely got to get programs in place to try to mitigate that and understand that. And, you know, that's, you know, comes as part of education and prevention and suppression and stride fire, you know, management and using these things. And I know, you know, the U.S. Forest Service really kind of took a beating as far as their policy went with the fires in New Mexico 2 years ago. And, being attributed to, escape control burns and, you know, but, you know, I know they shut down their program and they revamped and, you know, are working to, you know, come up with a better program as far as their prescribed fire goes. So, you know, that's going to be, definitely a focus, I think, for land management agencies is introducing fire, you know, safely, you know, back into the, you know, to the forest and to the wildland. And then also, you know, what do you do with the urban interface? And, you know, how do you prep and prepare? Because, you know, fires are inevitable. They're going to come and we're going to have to deal with them. And it's just how prepared are we and where's our best defense really is.
Right. And not, you know, and we talk about fires, right? But we're really also largely talking about ember defense, right? If the fire's not within, you know, 50 or 60 feet of your house, that radiant heat's not going to get you. But those embers collecting up in your wooden mulch and in your gutters and your attic, like that's going to get you. And that is something that could be mitigated relatively inexpensively compared to, you know, thinning operations. So I think you're right.
Absolutely.
I think we're going to see some policy change there.
Yeah, if you look at it and can basically retrofit homes, you know, in the urban interface, those that are already existing, you know, with fire resistant, you know, materials, you know, cover up your eaves, you know, instead of a shake shingle roof, maybe, you know, put a tile roof on it or a metal roof. Same with your siding. Don't stack your wood pile underneath your wood deck, you know, behind your house and get you 30, 50 feet of defensible space around your home, you know, and those are, you know, when you go through and, you know, you drive through these, towns and areas that have been devastated by wildfire, you know, you'll see homes that made it and stood and all their neighbors didn't. And usually the common denominator is what that home was built out of and then what the landscaping was around it. And, you know, and they survived. They survived those fires. So
losing the house is not an inevitability.
Right, exactly. And like you said, you don't need direct flame impingement on these homes to catch them on fire. You know, just embers from the fire itself or from the neighbor's house. If it catches, you know, it's gonna, you know, impact you know, the neighbor's home as well. And then, but instead built out of the correct materials and the right preparation, those homes can survive.
Yeah. So it, given that the neighbor's house could light your house, you know, that really does point that this is, this needs to be community-based solution.
Absolutely,
every individual doing what they can, but communities working together, particularly at the perimeter homes.
Yeah, particularly there, you know, because like you said, just like in the Marshall Fire, when once it got into the homes, it kind of really didn't matter. I mean, you're blocks away from the grass. I mean, you're in the middle of a subdivision, paved roads, and, you know, you wouldn't think would, you know, you'd
car dealerships
kind of
and hotels,
yeah.
and Starbucks, and, you know, just this doesn't look like fireland, right? Yeah,
exactly. But once it establishes, you know, in the structures, it's, you know, especially in conditions like the Marshall Fire. I mean, those are hurricane force winds, you know, and it was dry, you know, and it was ready. And so, you know, once it, you know, went from the grass and cut that, you know, those first structures, you know, they just, it just runs through the structures like it ran through the grass and ran through the trees.
Right.
It
was,
it's really
I
no
described
different.
It as a wildfire where the homes were the trees.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got a question for you. You know, with your old special agent hat on, maybe the badge too.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes you don't discuss ideas because you don't want to give ideas. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw wildfires, you know, as the next form of terrorism, because it you know, with a lighter, you can take out a whole town with no planning, no, you know, co-defendants, right? Co-conspirators. I mean, this is, you know, you can cause a lot of damage with very little effort. And I'm wondering, you know, I can't be the only person who's thinking that that could be a problem. I'm wondering, you know, is that something that Homeland Security is working on? Is that something that the Forestry Department is working on? And if so, what do you do about it? How do you protect against it or detect it or? What do you
think? So that you know, that's a great topic. And that was definitely, you know, a part of our concerns, I'll just say, you know, when I was in the government. So from a, you know, national security standpoint, absolutely, that was on our radar as a, you know, terrorist activity that could, you know, impact, you know, not maybe not so much as, you know, devastation as trying to burn down a, you know, take lives or, you know, burn down a home, but it's tying up resources and they are very expensive. And, you know, it takes all hands on deck, you know, when, you know, we've seen it when these fires rage, like we've seen like the North Bay fires in 2017, 2018, that completely overtook, you know, an area for many months, you know, really over two fire seasons or three, you know, 17, 18, and 19. So, yeah, absolutely. So it could definitely be a terrorism tool store, and that's definitely on the radar.
And we certainly don't want
agencies.
That, you know, but in terms of like preparedness and response, you know, when I look at a wildfire campaign, it always occurs to me that if it were a military campaign instead of a civilian campaign, there'd be a whole lot more money and technology thrown into it, right? They're, you know, they'd have satellites that could put out, you know, fires from space with ray guns, and, you know, Boeing and Lockheed and everybody else would have really amazing technology. And, you know, they would take a lot of the danger out of this because they'd have really cool toys that would do the work, robots. But, you know, that doesn't happen on civilian firefighting budgets. So I'm wondering if, you know, if we saw more of the misuse of fire by miscreants, and it became more of a Homeland Security issue or military threat issue, do you think we might see more, you know, military style budgets thrown against this?
Well, I think, that was definitely identified as a problem, you know, for sure, as, you know, terrorism, you know, via arson. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there'd definitely be a focus there, whether it, you know, I don't know if the U.S. Forest Service budget would increase. I don't know exactly how that would go. But yeah, you just look at the DOD budget versus, you know, the budget of the U.S. Forest Service. I mean, it's, Yeah,
And then
it's
there's this sense in the budget world that that causation determines the budget for the response rather than the result, right? If 3 people die in house fires, maybe they send you over and you figure out who caused it, and not a big budget spent there, but 3 Marines die overseas, boy, you're going to see $1 billion easily spent, right, to remedy,
right.
rectify, and prevent that from happening again. And in my mind, human life is human life,
I
and
agree.
it seems like a disproportionately small response when it's fire versus an identifiable enemy.
Well, and I'll say, and from my perspective, looking at this, and this is where I think we have a lot of room for improvement. In this world, is you need to properly identify, solidly identify what's causing your fires, and regardless of what that leads to, that with no bias, that we
Right.
find out, is it, could it be tied to terrorism? Is it just a power line problem? Is it just a, just next to our railways, I mean, that's what's causing all whatever it is.
Yeah.
But you to like I'd said before, to prevent that, you need to have solid facts and data pointing to the cause, and then you really have to, be solid on that so you can make decisions, moving forward as far as prevention goes, whatever that is, if it's
Right, we got to
military action or
get the
more budget or
science
whatever.
first. Yeah.
Yeah, we got to know what's causing it first, and so that's where a budget would help greatly in the natural resource agencies that are responsible for investigating fires. Is we need more qualified, properly trained, experienced, and properly mentored wildland fire investigators, so we can rely on this data. And that we can properly investigate more and more fires, because it's I've seen reports to where, and we'd have to fact check some of this stuff, but up to maybe 40, 50% of wildland fires are investigated. So,
That sounds high, even, right?
yeah, and that even sounds high. And then properly investigated is a whole nother number,
Right.
much lower, because. And it's just really a lack of resources, of human resources, of qualified individuals, because you can get trained, if you can get FI-210 and get minimally trained and maybe fill out your task book and get red card qualified through NWCG or whatever, so you can be a proper wildland fire investigator. But really, in my opinion, there's as much art as it is science.
Yep.
And you really have to understand fire and been staring at fire for a very, very long time. And because it really takes that kind of eye and that experience, because every fire is different. No two fires are going to be the same or even close to the same. And it takes as much effort to investigate a 1 acre fire as it does 100,000 acre. Take really
Sure.
no different, because it all comes down to the origin area. And
Yeah.
that's where you got to be solid on that, and that's where you find the origin, is where you find the cause. And
Yeah, right.
so you need to be able to do that and do it effectively. And so yeah, I would love to see some type of mentorship program. The training's there. I think we're pretty solid on that. It's the after the training and getting these new fire investigators, and even some that have been around for a while, they just haven't had a lot of exposure, is to get them paired up with a solid qualified investigator that can teach them the ropes and show them how to do it. And then you got to go out and do it. You got to get a
Yeah,
lot
right.
of investigations under your belt, even get any kind of comfortable. It's extremely difficult, and a lot of people don't like to do it. You got to kind of have a passion for it, because it is hot and dirty and nasty, and it takes a long time, and it's definitely not always glamorous, that's for sure. But so, but I know there's folks out there that are very interested in it and want to do it. I think we just need to, increase those budgets, And let's get us some more investigators out there.
Absolutely. Luke, I'm going to let you get back to investigating in just a minute. I just since you brought up the topic of mentorship, you when you were getting started in this, who was helpful to you?
We had some just in my area here, predominantly here in the Southwest U.S. We just had some of the old dogs that had been around forever and kind of started like me. Most special agents, law enforcement, U.S. Forest Service, a lot of them started in fire, so I had a good strong fire behavior background. And then, of course, moved on to law enforcement investigations and became fire investigators and became really good at it because they had that background and really already had a career, in fire and thrill of fire and understanding it. And so those are the guys, and gals that I learned from. And it was
Was there
literally
one
just
person
being
who
there.
particularly stood out and, saw the
Oh,
possibility in you and gave you the right encouragement and said,
it's kind of a
come hang
long
out under my
list.
wing for a minute? It's a long
Yeah,
list.
it's a pretty good list. I was pretty fortunate, to be able to have a good group, and not just locally here in Arizona, New Mexico. I had, investigators that we work with for CAL FIRE, for the U.S. Forest Service, for Bureau of Land Management. Yeah, I had a lot of opportunity, and I was fortunate to where when the new NWCD training came out and FI 210, back in the early 2000s, is being one of the first to go through that training. And most of those that wrote the book on that would come out and put on that training. That's
Yeah.
where I learned a lot also, was from
Luke,
that group.
if people think they may need your investigative services or would love you to mentor them, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
The best is go to my website. It's wildlandfireinvestigation.com, and yeah, shoot me an email, or just I put my number on there, and you can just call me direct,
Beautiful.
and we can talk.
Awesome. I appreciate your candid answers to a tough problem, and I appreciate you joining us here on the fire break. Thanks
Absolutely,
so much
Steve.
for spending some time with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So I look forward to talking in the future. And yeah, I understand you're out of Boulder, and yeah, I'll be up there doing some Marshall Fire stuff in April. So maybe we
Well,
touch again.
please let me know and let's go out and have a meal together.
Absolutely.
All right, great. That's Luke Wolf. Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening or watching The Fire Break. The Fire Break is sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing new technologies for reducing the impact of the world's most dangerous fires. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you at the next one. Take care.